Chapter 34. It wasn't long, 12 minutes by Bishop's internal timer, before the Queen's attacks on the elevator began to taper off. It would slam itself against the doors for a while, then stop for minutes on end. Bishop suspected it had sensed other prey approaching, and when it didn't come within easy reach, the Queen returned to continue pounding away at the elevator. Each time, the metal complained and bent a little bit more, but still wouldn't give way enough to let the thing in. In fact, the doors shouldn't have buckled at all. As he went on pulling up tiles, Bishop wondered who was going to break it to Weyland-Yutani that their impervious alloy, currently the standard material for space stations everywhere, wasn't alien-proof. Or maybe an enterprising administrator had swapped out the alloy for something cheaper than cooked the books to pocket the difference. Admin's sleight of hand had fooled a number of savvy contractors in the past. He had a sudden memory of something Sergeant Appone had said to Hicks. Make something foolproof and nature will make a better fool. Bishop didn't know if Appone was right, but he did know that something, maybe nature, maybe a better fool, had somehow created a species more dangerous than Homo sapiens. Any fool who couldn't see that wasn't the better kind. The last floor tile came away, exposing the trap door. Long strings of industrial glue hung from the underside of the tile, showing it was a recent installation. Why maintenance would floor over the emergency exit was yet another vagary of human behavior Bishop didn't even try to account for. There was no lock on the door, which opened out and down, assuming it wasn't boarded up on the other side. Newt would have crossed her fingers. As she wasn't there to do the honors, he did it for her. Then he pressed the latch and the door dropped open. Lucky again. At this rate, he might become the first superstitious artificial person. Bishop lowered himself through the hole and dangled by his hands while he checked things out. All four shaft walls had service ladders tucked into recesses, presumably for the safety of maintenance crews, although Bishop thought they could have been deeper. Husky types risked having their clothes torn off. At the bottom of the shaft, he saw the flickering orange glow of an ongoing fire. Judging by the unpleasant, pungent smell, it was something illegal to burn in any environment that was home to air breathers. He could tolerate polluted air better than humans could, but his olfactory function told him that for the sake of his more delicate components, he would be wise not to prolong his exposure. And that was going to be trickier than he had anticipated. The trapdoor's position put him a meter short of the nearest ladder. Can't hang around here all day. Filing the thought under accidental humor to share with Hicks later, Bishop put his feet together and worked at making his body swing back and forth. He increased the arc, despite the car shuddering in his grip, as the Queen continued its assault on the doors. In only a few seconds, he managed to build up to the right amount of momentum. One somersault would be enough, he thought, and used the human trick of counting down while he double-checked his calculations. 3, 2, 1, mark, he said aloud, putting extra force into the forward swing before he let go. The cheap polycarbon knees twinged as he curled into a tight ball and twinged again when he straightened out and reached for the ladder. His hands closed on empty air. Rungs flashed past him like frames of an antique film strip for a full second before he caught one, checking his fall with a jerk hard enough to make his eyeballs bounce in their sockets. Hanging by one arm, he conducted a quick internal survey. The sudden stop hadn't done any additional damage. Maybe he should count that as another lucky break. Not bad for an artificial person, he said aloud, remembering Ripley struggling out of the airlock after she'd sent the Queen from LV-426 into the void. In the silence that followed, Newt had called her Mommy. Bishop hadn't experienced the moment as a human would have, but he understood its nature and profundity in the abstract, and he'd saved the memory on board as critical data. He began climbing down, quickly but not hurriedly, trying to minimize the time each leg had to bear his weight. Every fifth rung or so, his knees would wobble, the left more so than the right. He estimated they would fail completely within the next 8 hours, and 8 might be too optimistic. But that was okay. He'd settle for 1. The air quality was getting worse, and a lot more quickly than Hicks had anticipated. The thickening smoke combined with the rough stink of chemicals stung their eyes, made them cough, and occasionally they had to stop and wait for someone to throw up. Hicks was the only one who hadn't needed a puke break. He'd come close a few times, but managed to keep his stomach contents to himself. He had to. The group needed him to be stronger than they were. Now a tightness was gathering at the base of his skull, faint as yet, but ready to blossom into the kind of headache that would make history if he let his guard down. The only way to hold it off was to do his job, to concentrate on getting everyone into a lifeboat and off this station. Occasionally they passed through areas where the air wasn't so bad, but he wouldn't let them linger more than a couple of minutes, telling them the air would be clearer up ahead. So far, they seemed to believe him. He hoped he wasn't lying. Some of the areas they passed through were especially bad, with more wreckage, more human bloodstains, much of it still wet on the cratered and scorched walls. In some places, acid blood had eaten through half a dozen levels before it had petered out. Several times Jackson had had to reroute them around collapsed tunnels and passageways. It made everything seem even more bleakly overwhelming, and the way Halliday kept blubbering didn't help. Hicks was on the verge of losing it and telling Halliday she had to shut up or they'd leave her behind when Martinez came up with the idea of a scavenger hunt in motion, looking for water bottles, thermoses, edibles in sealed packaging, and any other useful items would get their minds working so they weren't thinking only about bad air, aliens, and how tired they were. Initially, Hicks had been skeptical. He was trying to distance them from death and destruction, not get them closer to it by pawing through debris. But to his surprise, the group's energy level rose and even Halliday stopped crying to join in. Rossetti's participation was limited to pointing at things and telling one of the techs to fetch it, although he did spare a moment to nod at Hicks approvingly. It only made Hicks want to punch him. Jackson found a couple of empty courier bags large enough to hold a fair amount of whatever they found. Hicks told the techs to take turns carrying them for the group, and they didn't object. Anchor Point lab techs seemed to be the civilian equivalent of grunts. Except for Spence, he thought. Spence was more like a sergeant on the officer track. The concourse took a wide curve to the left and started gradually sloping upward, much to Hicks's dismay. The last thing they needed now was more physical effort. Then he realized the air was better and less smoky. The burning smell was still there, but they weren't coughing as much and the puking had stopped.
"Even the small victories count, Marine," Appone grinned at him in his mind's eye. "Every meal a banquet, every paycheck a fortune. Remember?"
It seemed like forever before the passageway leveled off into an open area Jackson said was a transport and traffic control substation. Tatsumi perked up at the word transport and suggested that Jackson activate a rail car for them, routing it to the nearest lifeboat bay. Everyone, including Martinez, was enthusiastically in favor of the idea, but all Hicks could think of was the last transport he'd seen, where he'd found Spence.
"That's the worst thing we could do!"
Spence's voice cut through the clamoring and they all shut up. Hicks knew she remembered the same thing and he distracted the group with a short break before herding them into a tunnel marked Maintenance. The tunnel was large and mercifully empty of any sort of wreckage, with weird acoustics that amplified every sound they made. Hicks didn't know whether this had actually triggered Halliday to begin another cycle of weeping or whether she had simply decided it was too quiet. As always, it was soft at first, but grew steadily louder, building to a crescendo of uncontrollable sobbing, and Hicks called a break so Spence and Jackson could talk her down. He had to be patient, he told himself. Halliday wasn't the first traumatized civilian he'd dealt with. She wasn't even the most difficult, nor was he stuck having to take care of her all by himself. It wasn't much of a pep talk. He was too tired to be mature. No, he was beyond tired. He was running on fumes, and not very strong fumes, more like fumes of fumes, ghosts of fumes. Driving the group so hard, refusing to let them rest for very long, was the only way he could keep himself going, because if he sat down for more than a minute or two, he'd never get up again. He dropped back a few meters as the group approached the next bend in the tunnel. Better to lag behind for a few deep breaths, otherwise he might lose it and start shouting at Halliday to stop sniveling and get her fucking shit together. The group rounded the turn, and he heard gasps and cries of terror before Halliday's hysterical sobs drowned them out. Then they were all rushing back toward him,
and for a moment he thought they were going to run over him like stampeding cattle.
Oh man, oh sweet Jesus, this is bad!
Martinez's gold-toned complexion was almost ashen, and the grip she had on his bicep was going to leave bruises.
It's so bad. It's real bad.
Suddenly, absurdly, finally, Hicks recognized her as the Marine he'd passed on his way to meet Tully a lifetime ago, the one who had punched his arm. Appone had been right. The damnedest things cross your mind at the damnedest times. He unslung his rifle and told all of them, including Martinez, to stay behind him. Whatever it was, he might be able to hold it off long enough for Martinez to get them out of there. Raising his weapon, he strode around the corner and stopped.
"Everybody stay back!" Hicks yelled when he could finally speak. "I mean it! Stay back!"
Instead, they bunched up behind him, not exactly obeying, but not disobeying too much. After some unmeasured time, Martinez said,
"Corporal Hicks, what the fuck is that?"
That was the question of the day, Hicks thought. And he hadn't had an answer anyone would like. And now he had no answer at all. As an artifact, the pearlescent black wall ceiling off the tunnel in front of him was remarkable, truly astonishing. Not because it was so large or complex. The aliens had covered over much larger spaces on LV-426, but this was the first time Hicks had known them to deliberately construct a barricade. It was also the first time he had seen human remains mixed into the stuff, flesh, bones, even body parts, in a way that was practically artful.
"Maybe it is art," Hicks thought, momentarily lightheaded. "Maybe they really are artists. Malevolent, violent, and lethal. But artists nonetheless. And they call this piece Dead End for Humanity, from their Extinction series." "Okay, road's closed, everyone. We gotta take a detour."
He herded the group back around the corner, refusing to let anyone stop for another look. Martinez took point again and led them into an area off the passageway Hicks had barely noticed before. Now he saw it was a brake lounge. Anchor Point seemed to have more of those than any other space station he'd been to, which meant he'd have to let everyone rest again, assuming they could rest while they were anywhere near that thing. Hicks would have preferred being a lot farther away. He looked around. As large as the lounge was, it had no vending machines, but it did have its own parking area. A couple of one- and two-seater carts lay on their sides amid a scatter of broken electronics, while against the wall on Hicks's left, a blood-stained tarp had been thrown over something large and lumpy. Hicks wasn't keen to take a closer look, but Martinez went over to it before he could stop her, and using the tip of her rifle, lifted a section of tarp a few centimeters to reveal a tire. Hicks let out a surprised laugh. Martinez went to pull the tarp back, but this time he moved quickly enough to stop her.
"Oh,
right," she said, frowning a little. "You want to shoot first?" He shook his head.
"If there's something nasty under there, let me flush it out so you can put it down. Hopefully, where it won't splash anyone. Jackson, move everybody back to the far wall." No one argued, although they all looked dubious, even after Jackson told them they could sit down.
Hicks slung his rifle and started running his hands over the tarp, while Martinez watched him with wide, dark eyes, her expression a mix of uncertainty and apprehension. The wall was a bad omen to them, he realized. If things kept going downhill, he'd have trouble keeping them together and pointed in the right direction. He shoved the thought away. Even if the six-wheeler looked intact, that didn't mean it would run. If the battery wasn't flat, the engine might be damaged, or maybe acid had eaten into the dashboard. And then again, maybe not. It felt pretty solid, and at this point, he knew nothing was lying in wait under the tarp. The aliens could be surprisingly stealthy, even cunning, but whenever prey got close, they couldn't help going into a frenzy. He poked the area covering the seats. Nothing happened.
"I'm pretty sure it's clear," he said to Martinez. "Let's see what we've got."
They pulled the tarp back. The transport was bloodstained, dented, and scraped, and there were chunks gouged out of the worn upholstery, but overall it looked okay. Martinez hopped into the driver's seat and pressed the starter on the dashboard. The vehicle came to life immediately. Martinez slumped in the seat and let out a long, relieved breath. Hicks felt a little emotional himself.
"Every so often, something good happens," he told Martinez, chuckling. "Now, let's get rolling."
Martinez took another deep breath before she sat up and climbed out.
"Okay, guys, our ride's here," she said. "All aboard. Now."
She didn't have to tell them twice, but to Hicks's surprise, Rossetti hung back, looking uncertain. Jackson took his arm, but he pulled away from her.
"They don't want us to get out," he said. "They want to trap us. You saw it. Blue Concourse is completely blocked."
"Then fuck Blue Concourse," Hicks snapped, "and fuck the fucking bugs that blocked it. This bus is leaving, Colonel. You and Martinez take our six. Jackson, your shotgun."
"Copy that, Corporal."
Martinez sounded matter-of-fact, despite a fleeting look of unease. Rossetti started to say something, but Martinez distracted him with a question about pulse rifles versus smart rifles. Hicks smiled inwardly. What she lacked in experience, she made up for in savvy. Getting everyone situated turned out to be a bit tricky. It was a tight squeeze, and Quill ended up in the backward-facing seat with Rossetti and Martinez. When they were all settled, Jackson jumped into the seat beside Hicks.
"Hit it!"
Hicks chuckled a little.
"Which way, ops?"
"Back the way we came," she said. "Unless you know something I don't."
Hicks shifted into drive, made a wide turn into the passageway, then stamped on the accelerator. The motion roused Halliday from her weepy fugue.
"What did he mean? Bugs? What bugs? And what was that thing we saw back there?"
Hicks could hear her squirming around between Spence and Talisa.
"Where's Tom? Where'd he go? And what was that thing back there?"
"It's nothing. It's okay," Spence said soothingly. "It was just an experiment that spilled."
"An experiment?"
Now Tatsumi was on the alert.
"I know of no such experiment. Why was I not informed?"
Jackson turned around in her seat and patted him on the knee reassuringly.
"Hey, don't worry, Dr. T. We'll explain later."
Hicks tightened his grip on the steering wheel, although his knuckles couldn't get any whiter. They were civilians, he told himself, just civilians, yanked out of their oblivious civilian existence by an alien shitstorm. No one had ever told them that in this life everyone was fair game and now it was their turn. It wasn't their fault. There was nothing wrong with them. It was the universe that was fucked up.
"Take the left coming up, marked B-33, Jackson said, consulting the map on her flexi.
"There isn't as much wreckage and it goes most of the way to aquaculture, but we'll have to get out and walk the last bit. Sorry," she added, glancing at Hicks apologetically. "From there we go up a level to aeroponics, which puts us close to residential. Then we climb the service tunnel behind the mainframe for this sector."
"Sounds complicated," Hicks said dubiously.
"Quickest route to a lifeboat bay," Jackson replied. "And by quickest, I mean I'm pretty sure there'll be more air than smoke and less dead ends made out of dried alien phlegm and several human limbs."
"Works for me," Hicks said.
Behind him, Halliday was asking about Tom again, while Tatsumi grumbled that people were failing to notify him about experiments. The development of artificial persons like Bishop had involved extensive research into human psychology in general, and the phenomenon of the Uncanny Valley in particular. When it came to making AIs in the image and likeness of humans, scientists found God and the devil slugging it out in the details, and it wasn't always clear which was which. A great deal of painstaking research and experimentation revealed humans had less trouble accepting artificial life forms that blinked, breathed, and swallowed, and, if at all possible, ate and drank. The first three behaviors turned out to be the most crucial. They were also fairly easy to build in, although the rates for each had to be carefully calibrated. Bishop's simulated respiration continued on its programmed loop, even though the air in the elevator shaft was now practically unbreathable for a human. Fortunately, the concentration of toxins was well below levels that would adversely affect the more delicate components of his neural net. A lot less fortunately, his legs were more at risk than his brain. Trousers weren't much protection for cheap polycarbon. He stepped sideways on each rung in an effort to distribute his weight along the length of his foot. It meant he couldn't move as quickly as he'd have liked, but hand under hand would have been even slower.
Four levels down, he stopped on a small ledge beside a set of double doors where the heat from the fire was more intense. As he felt around on the wall for the emergency lever, he ran a quick status check. Heat damage wasn't imminent, but it advised him to move to a cooler environment with fewer airborne toxins.
To quote Corporal Hicks, "No shit," he muttered, and discovered the air tasted even worse than it smelled.
After a few seconds, he found the lever. The metal was warm, but not hot enough to damage his skin. It wouldn't budge. Bishop shifted position, tried again. It loosened, but only a tiny bit. Moving up a couple of rungs, he pushed down on the thing with all his weight. Metal scraped sharply against metal as the lever finally gave. The doors slid apart and he dived through them headfirst as air rushed past him into the shaft. There was a distant whomp from the conflagration below. For a moment, he thought the influx of air would cause a vertical flashover and bring the fire up to where he was. But when he looked over his shoulder, he saw only a puff of tiny sparks dancing madly in the dark shaft.
He sat up and scanned his surroundings, taking a note of all the plastic crates, some in stacks, some scattered all over the deck.
There had to be another lever to close the doors from this side, but he didn't see anything on the wall or in his reference data. The call panel beside the doors lit up with a message: "Danger, empty shaft, call maintenance." A couple of seconds later, the doors closed by themselves and a new message appeared: "Out of service for maintenance. Use alternative."
"If there is one," Bishop said under his breath.
Talking to himself aloud every so often was a behavior he had deliberately cultivated after discovering that, for some reason, it put people around him at ease. Even the Colonial Marines. No, especially the Marines. And he wouldn't have thought little behaviors would affect them. He piled a couple of upside-down crates on top of each other and used them to push himself to his feet. In one direction, the passageway narrowed into darkness. Fortunately, he was going the other way, where the lights were still on, and even with the stacks of crates there was enough room for a small vehicle. Or there had been, before so many had been knocked down and scattered all over. Given the destruction and chaos he'd already seen, Bishop supposed it would have been surprising if he'd found them all still in neat stacks. On the other hand, perhaps the total absence of blood and human remains and acid damage was stranger. Whatever had happened here hadn't killed anyone. Then he came to the six-wheeled transport stalled atop a small heap of crates. Definitely an argument in favor of luck being a real thing, Bishop thought, climbing into the driver's seat. And the blinking battery recharge light on the dashboard to let him know his luck had run out was another. Only real things ran out. He tried the I.O. button anyway, just in case, but there was only a click. Well, now he knew for certain, he thought, and decided to rest his legs in the hope it would make them feel less precarious. Although, with so few nerve connections, his physical sensation was barely more reliable than luck. Bishop gave it a full minute, then headed for the fusion chamber. If the map on his flexi wasn't too much off scale, he was fairly close. Setting the package to blow on the original schedule, or, he checked the time, something close to it, was still possible. The chances of having enough time to get to a lifeboat afterward, however, were slim to none. And, as Hudson would have put it, Slim had already evacuated. His left leg wobbled, reminding him there was a set order to the things he was concerned about. If there was a medical clinic near the fusion chamber, it might have a supply of nanos he could transfuse, as well as splints and pressure bandages. Although he'd have settled for duct tape and reinforcing rods from a construction site. Checking the time again only told him what he already knew. He was going to have to run. Maybe he could run faster than his legs were deteriorating.